When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Outward, Slate's show about the L's, the B's, the LGBTQ pluses. Don't ever try and say those slowly before you've had all of your morning coffee. I'm Jules Gill Peterson, apparently adrift somewhere in an acronym.
I'm Brian Lauder. I'm an editor at Slate. And Jules, listen, we're recording early today, and I feel you. I just woke up from a dream, like, I don't know, an hour and a half ago, where I was, like, the catering services for this new season of Drag Race.
Oh, my God.
But it was, like, Drag Race on tour, and we were, like, staying in elementary school, so I was having to cook for all of these queens, like, in a cafeteria. And it was extremely stressful, and they were not grateful for my effort, so... That's the energy that I'm bringing into the show this morning.
I bet you look really cute in a catering outfit, though.
That's true. You know, in dreams, you usually can't see yourself, but I bet I did. Yeah, I'm sure you're right.
I can see it. Well, speaking of production, you know, because of last year's writer's strikes and actor's strike, shout out to organized labor, we're kind of knee deep in an awards season sandwich. I don't know if it's like it's a hero or a grinder or a sub, depending on where you live, but a really, really big, long, never-ending season. So, you know, if... kind of like me, never really knew what the difference was between a Golden Globe and an Emmy. Well, who cares anymore? Because it's sort of impossible even to remember which show's red carpet looks you were even scrolling on your feed last night anyways. But one thing is definitely true. There is a lot of queer and trans talent nominated and being recognized across film and television this year, although across a bunch of other media too at other awards shows. So we couldn't possibly take on all of that. We thought we would just break a little piece of it off and dive in. So on today's show, Brian and I are joined by extra special guest, Jeff Bloomer, who's going to help us sort through all of our feelings about All of Us Strangers, the new Andrew Hay film starring Andrew Scott and Paul Mescal as a pair of lonely gay neighbors, then lovers, in a London high-rise whose attachment, formed kind of in the hollow of some shattering grief, comes with a pretty surreal and haunting twist. But first, Brian, I think it's time for some prides and or provocations, if you got one for me.
I could not let January go without discussing Shelby and Dolly. Do you know what I mean by Shelby and Dolly?
But
okay, I will remind all of our listeners. It has been a little while, so it's fine. This was the gay couple who went viral freaking out about an American Airlines flight after Christmas. Yes, that's right. I'm talking about Dustin Anthony and, quote, their girls, Shelby and Dolly. If y'all missed this, it's worth going, like, just Googling it and going and watching the video, because I can't really convey it all here. But basically, a flight was delayed and then eventually canceled, I think. It's two gay guys of a certain age. One partner is freaking out and yelling and being very inappropriate. The other is trying to calm him down. And the way he tries to calm him down is like, remember the girls, baby, we're going back home. Don't forget about the girls. Like, we're just trying to get home.
Blast.
And then one of them, like, cusses out a lady who's in a wheelchair. It's, like, very, it's a lot and sort of intense. But I wanted to process on the show how to feel about this. In part because I was someone who flew out of Charlotte on that same day. So I was in the airport. My family is down around there. I was in the airport when this happened. Obviously, I am provoked by the behavior and the gay representation, right? This is not
what representation.
Well, this is not what we want. This is not how we want to be out in the world and the community being. It's messy. It's mean. They were sad. They needed to go home. But I share in their provocation at American Airlines, because when has that company not been a problem?
An airline that does not respect the girls.
Does not respect the girls at all. Does not respect me. I don't fly them. Like, there's always a problem. Always a problem. So I understand that. But then, and this is, you know, the reason that it went viral, we've got Shelby and Dolly. Now, I knew immediately in my heart of hearts that these were dogs. I did not need anybody to tell me that. I turned to my partner, Cam, and I was like, those are dogs. They're definitely dogs.
100%.
And then, of course, social media sleuths dug this up. Indeed, they were dogs named after, almost certainly, Steel Magnolias. Great detail there being one is a character and one is just Dolly Parton, who plays a role in it. So it's like an actress.
That's very gay.
And a character. It's so gay. It's so gay to choose one
and
of
Southern.
to choose one of each category. Incredible gay naming choices for the dog. So I'm kind of proud of them for that. So this is a mixed bag for me. I don't know. I think generally it's a nasty situation on the ground. You know, they needed to not scream at people in the airport. But I'm going to remember the girls, I think, for the rest of my life, Jules. I don't know.
That's really beautiful. And I think it shows a lot of maturity and wisdom, because I don't know if I can tolerate gay men comparing women to dogs anymore. I'm just kidding. And, you know, American Airlines, unfortunately, thanks to Ronald Reagan's deregulation of the airline industry, you know, is like the thing I'm forced to fly because I live near a hub. And yeah, let me tell you, it's not my favorite experience. One day I'll tell the story about how I was actually seated, you know, in a full P100 PPE mask beside one Marjorie Taylor Greene on a flight from Atlanta to DC. But that's a story for another episode.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I didn't solve the problems of America. Spoiler.
Oh my God. I can't wait to hear that. But for now, Jules, do you have a brighter provocation for us?
Not for the first time, and I'm sure not for the last time. I am provoked by the Ohio State Legislature. You know, sorry to be kind of a doomsday sayer here, but, you know, we're recording at the end of January, and it's been quite a start to the year in terms of anti-trans political campaigning and violence, legislative violence, at least, just to set the stage as of recording. You know, we're near the end of the first month of the year. Seem to have had 300 anti-LGBTQ bills introduced in state legislatures. Most of those are anti-trans. Just to put that in comparison, last year was like by far the most earth-shatteringly worst year we've ever seen. We almost hit 600 pieces of legislation introduced. Over 80 were passed. But we're at the end of January and we've almost hit half of that already for the year. So this is not a good sign. But Ohio, you know, listeners, you probably remember that at the end of December, the Ohio State Legislature passed a pretty draconian law that sort of sandwiched, that's my favorite verb today for some reason, sandwiched together, you know, a ban on participation in sports with a ban on gender-affirming healthcare for youth. And then, you know, the governor, DeWine, actually vetoed that bill. And at the time, this is, you know, right around Christmas, I was pretty grumpy about the journalistic coverage. He's a Republican. But if you look into it, he vetoed it on a pro-life basis, which like...
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah,
but also, you know, in his actual veto statement, he's like, I don't want to sign this bill into law because, as I understand it, it stands a large likelihood of being found unconstitutional. And I would much rather we create new state regulations on medicine that... are even more, you know, restrictive. For example, might restrict trans adults' ability to transition, kick them off their prescriptions, forcibly detransition adults in the state of Ohio.
Right.
But because, you know, state regulation powers function differently than just a blanket ban under the law, his reasoning was, oh, these have a much higher likelihood of surviving any legal challenge. And I hate to say it, but I think he was right about that. This is a really, really serious problem. This is why I'm provoked. Because I think actually, you know, these moments of like hollow victory where a right-wing politician is like, oh, we can't pass this like just literal discrimination bill are not victories.
Yeah.
And they're often the pretext for going through, you know, administrative means to actually do even more harm. But administrative revision just doesn't have the same patina as a law. And it doesn't get covered the same way. It's much more hard to understand. And also like trans healthcare is already a mess of regulation. And so the reason why we're vulnerable to this in a way like other people aren't when they do the same things that we do or take the same hormones we do is because of this like awful medical system that just burdens us with ridiculous amounts of you know, oversight to begin with and interference in our bodily autonomy. But anyways, what did I have to worry about? Because the Ohio State Legislature just overruled the governor's veto. And so this, you know, now Ohio will be the 22nd state in the country to ban gender-affirming care for minors. It's sad news, but there's something about the kind of like, I don't know, centrifuge of devastation here where like every outcome was really bad and they were kind of just like swirling around each other and then one ended up winning the day and it's horrific. I just think that's where we are right now. That's what I see for 2024. I really think, you know, well, just to say we're losing these battles. It's pretty terrible. I don't have faith in the judiciary's ability to to stop this tidal wave. And so I'm feeling, I mean, provoked is just beginning to scratch the surface, but I'm pretty concerned. There's a lot on our plates for 2024, but trans people's very, very viability of being able to have any minimal sovereignty over their bodies is really on the line this year more than ever. And this might prove to be, in a sad sort of way, a kind of definitive year. So just sorry to start the new year off like that, but I gotta.
No need to be sorry. I mean, that's it's something that's it's sadly true, and it's something that we're going to be covering this year. Like you said, I think that is obviously the way things are going, and it's very serious and very disturbing. No need to be sorry about that. All right, well, we will have a quick break and we'll be back to talk about All of Us Strangers. Back. All of Us Strangers is the new film from English writer-director Andrew Hay, who's best known for his widely beloved Weekend, the 2015 feature 45 Years, and the, let's say, divisive HBO series Looking, which was about a group of gay men navigating sex, friendship, loneliness, and the streets of mid-2010 San Francisco. All of Us Strangers is Hay's first major release since the pandemic, and it's largely been greeted with praise by critics. The narrative is a sort of complicated, moody gay romance, this time within the garb of a ghost story. It follows lonely 40-something screenwriter Adam, played by Andrew Scott, and his budding relationship with the younger Harry, played by Paul Mescal, who I think we all agree is nice to see on screen. They are seemingly the only residents of an eerie apartment building outside of London. When he's not getting to know Harry in fits and starts, Adam spends his time traveling by train to his childhood home for chats with his parents, which is somewhat surprising since they both died in a car accident when he was 12. These spectral conversations allow Adam to come out to his parents and attempt to catch them up on his life, which is a moving, if sometimes to me, confusing exercise. Likewise, his interactions with Harry allow for the exploration of intergenerational gay themes like identity and AIDS trauma, as well as an accidental ketamine trip, which features prominently in the film. The whole thing is really lovely and hazy and sometimes baffling, with a twist ending that is nothing if not bold. Many gays are gushing about it, but I've also heard more so in back channels that some are finding it, and these are quotes, vacuous, outdated, and saccharine. So we've got a real division. Since the movie is now rolling out widely, we thought it would be a good time to discuss and figure out the truth. To help us do that, we've brought in Slate editorial director and gay about the cinema, Jeff Bloomer, who is an avowed Hay appreciator. Welcome, Jeff.
Hello.
Thanks so much for being here. So before we get started, I just wanted to warn our listeners that we are going to be discussing the ending of the film and spoilers. So if you haven't seen it yet and you care about spoilers, maybe wait to listen to the conversation until after you've done that. Before we get into it, let's listen to a clip.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
All right, as usual, kind of want to start just by hearing general reactions. Were y'all moved by this? Were you technically impressed? I know my introduction was a little loaded. Did you find it, you know, baffling in terms of what it was trying to do? Let's just hear what our general reactions were. Maybe Jeff, let's start with you since you're our guest today.
Okay, so Brian sort of knows this, but I'm a fan of Andrew Hay. I have an uncomplicated relationship with Looking. I actually think it's fine.
Yeah.
I really like his other movies. My favorite movie of his is actually the movie where like a young boy and a horse like have horrible things happen to them called Lean on Pete. Very good director, in my opinion. I really think he's good. I expected to like have a similarly uncomplicated relationship with this movie, but then I saw it and I was like, what the fuck is going on with this? There was a lot of things that were lovely about it, as you say. There's perfectly good sex scenes. It's like sweet, kind of. Most of these like sort of complicated conversations with a person who's closeted into his 40s. All of it was like okay, but the full Sixth Sense turn of it and all of it, I was just like, what on earth is he thinking? And apparently, the novel has barely anything to do with the actual movie, so it was like.
Yeah, it's based on a novel,
right? It's a Japanese novel, which is a much different context, apparently. But I found it to be extremely, extremely mysterious. I don't know if I thought it was vacuous. It was just weird, and like I have no idea what he was going. I don't get the movie. Really, it's basically where I was.
Yeah, vacuous might be a strong word, but it is one I heard for real. Jules, what was your reaction?
Pretty similar. Like, you know, I will say I have appreciated Andrew Hay in the past. Like when Weekend came out, I was like, okay, this feels very au courant. gay men, kind of sad, kind of empty. Hey, it's the 21st century. There's a malaise out there. Sometimes you have a hookup. Sometimes it's nice to have pleasure. How much does it really deliver? Does it ever change your life? Eh, not really. But hey, at least we're not straight, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. But then, like, within 5 minutes of All of Us Strangers starting, I was like, oh my God, here we are in the same world of, like, imagine being a lonely gay guy. And I'm like, no, totally, totally. I have imagined it with you before, darling. The thing that really, as someone who has plenty of diagnosed childhood traumas, but whose parents are, you know, mercifully still alive, I just did not like the conceit of being able to go visit, like, you know, your dead parents and being able to have all these, like, brutal, cathartic, like conversations with them, like the kind, like it all felt to me like the sort of exercise that maybe I imagine like a BetterHelp therapist would, you know, give a depressed professional gay man, like, why don't you write a letter? Why don't you write a dialogue conversation to your parents? What would you say to them? And what do you think you need to hear from them? And it's like, I don't know. I can suspend disbelief for one of those, but like by the like 10th time, there's one of these like everyone's crying and saying all the right things and then like having 100,000 like reparative catharses. I was just like, it actually grossed me out. I was like, is this nice to anyone? Like, I don't even know what kind of wish fulfillment that is because it just seemed so divorced from like from the experience of suffering in the real world. Like the whole point is like, yeah, you don't get to go and get closure with people when things like that happen, but like, are we really supposed to imagine that that would be anything but like an excruciating, bizarre, kind of humiliating experience? Maybe that's what the film is saying. I don't know. I just actually, like, in those moments found myself like guffawing and being like, I'm falling completely out of this little universe, which, you know, I think maybe matters when the universe is kind of surreal and metaphysical, right? Like it's not, you know, there's like a bit of a speculative or sci-fi twist to this film. And so by the time all of that stuff was happening, I was like, I'm sorry, you lost me a long time ago. And I was just sort of admiring Claire Foy's hair. But, you know, I don't know.
Well, I think a useful thing that is, I actually wanted to talk about sort of the therapy of it all. So I'm glad
the hair.
No, well, the hair is great, but no, the therapy of it all. But let's. I think maybe a good thing to do because you've both brought up sort of the two threads of the movie, right? We've got this. Mm-hmm. We've got this romance between these two men that's in this sort of isolated, you know, apartment building, and then we've got the parental sort of ghost story encounter thing that's happening, right? Do we think these like work together? I have heard some people say they don't think it does. That there was a review in New York Mag by Allison Williams where I think the headline was basically, this is like two movies trying to be one, right? My feeling was that the romance was sort of boring and empty because partially because we didn't get to know anything really about Paul Mescal's character, about Harry. There's like nothing there. And it's hard to like invest too much in that. The parental story about this re-encounter and this, you know, this ability to sort of come out in that format is a little more interesting to me. So anyway, what did you guys think about the two stories together? Did it work?
I didn't have that much of an issue with the way the stories were next to each other because they were channeling the same sort of shit. Like this guy has an inability to come out and he's obviously like experiencing intimacy for the first time. And with the parents also like kind of like slowly drawing that out of himself. But they were uncomfortable next to each other because I think Jules identified something that like the thing with the parents is weirdly sexual, right? Like from the very beginning, he first sees his father, he's like,
oh yeah,
cruising his father, and like who wasn't in that theater cruising Jamie Bell, right? It was a great first encounter, and then right. The mom too is like touching his chest and being like, oh, I thought she would have been hairy like your father, like
what? Yeah,
that part of it is so strange, and so the movie dovetails in that way too. That his sexual awakening is happening in both parts.
Yeah,
it's very, very uneasy and weird. I I know that Slate ran like a sort of explainer, like connecting the dots of the movie for people who wish to have such a thing done for them by Sam Adams, who's a great Slate writer. And I just, even after reading that, I'm still like, I don't understand exactly what was happening there. Like what the goal was with those strange moments.
I was, as I've said, like very confused by this movie and kind of not like in a plot sense, but just like, what is it for a sense? So I wasn't a big fan, but as we're talking about it, I actually am feeling, and it's because you brought up the word sentiment, Jules, or like sentimental. There is like something lovely about its commitment to sentimentality, but it does bleed over into comedy too much. I'm glad that you said that, because I found myself amused in ways that I don't think I was meant to be exactly in those scenes. And I felt kind of like gross about it. I was like I don't know how to like situate myself in relation to this storytelling, because it's giving me mixed messages, you're like mixed signals kind of about how I'm supposed to feel. Parent scenes are very much that way. I think to the one dimensionality point, like the fact that they both exist just only in his personal imaginative world or writerly world maybe makes them one dimensional and kind of it's kind of controlling, actually. It's like they aren't really like human parents that have, you know, complicated relationships to sexuality or to their child or whatever. They're these weird empty figures that he's like projecting onto. And I think I wanted to go back to like the therapy point that you brought up, because this struck me as a movie where therapeutic ideas, like sort of writing a letter to your childhood self, right? Or like re-encountering, reparenting the inner child, had been turned into art, or had attempted to be turned into art. And I think that's something we've seen a lot recently, like in the last, I don't know, 5 years or so, like especially around trauma, kind of turning like, I went and processed my trauma and now I'm going to make a story about it. And I think it often kind of turns out weird, let's say. I don't want to say bad always, but just kind of like strange. I wondered if y'all had like thoughts about that process, because it struck me as, I think like one of the things that was uncomfortable about this is it almost felt too personal to the director maybe. And I found myself, just a little, I don't know, feeling like I was sitting in on someone's therapy sessions and not knowing what to do with it. Does that ring true at all?
There's a flatness to the actual sentiment they arrive at. I promise you, I'm very sentimental about gay white men relationships. Like I this should have spoke to me if it was going to speak to someone, okay?
Yeah.
But I was watching this movie and it was just, it didn't, I have a relationship not that different than this guy had with his dead parents. Like it's in the realm, but there's just something about it that like you're waiting for an extra layer. You're waiting for something a little bit more to happen, or them to go a little deeper in some way, because it just doesn't, there's never really an aha moment, except for when this movie thinks it has one at the end. I'm so confounded watching this. And I don't mind basic gay stuff. I really did like looking. I just, for this movie, it felt like he thought that he was like hitting on some profundity and that was just not there. I think it gets to your point. It's there's a lot of emotion going on, but it has actually tapped into much. That was sort of,
yeah, no, I'm so glad you put it that way, Brian. I think you're so right. Let me land with a kind of a hot take. So I'm feeling warmed up from our conversation. You know, I think part of the problem with making every character dependent on trauma and then trying to do something with that is that the actual structure of trauma, and in this case, there's a real genuine trauma,
sure,
the loss of two parents, like that's really substantial.
And a horrific accident, right?
But part of the problem with that is it is so singular, right? And the weird thing about transposing these kind of therapy practices is that like part of the problem with trauma is that it's so difficult to communicate, and often the forms that it takes for people, the things that repeat, the things that, you know, that we've sort of boiled down to like these cheaper ideas of like triggers and da da da, they often are really weird and generic, and like they don't, it's not obvious like from their content why they would be wounding or difficult, mm-hmm. and they're not necessarily beautiful. They could often just seem really stupid and annoying and repetitive. Just saying too much about myself right now, but but part of the problem with that is like I think this whole trauma industry in pop culture thinks that like because trauma is supposed to be like the worst category of things that can happen to people, that it's like therefore the strongest grounds for sympathy ever that we could have, and yeah. it's more emotionally raw and genuine. And I actually just like don't think that's true. Like I don't think trauma is actually a very good grounds for sympathy, because it's often so profoundly isolating, individualizing, and enigmatic. Like, and there's a way that this film is so private. Like I really take to heart what you're saying, that like the character Adam is a screenwriter, and perhaps like the parents aren't even supposed to be his real parents. They're just sort of like these like figments, not only of his imagination, but of his writerly self. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm willing to actually say then that kind of gives context to the weirdness of those scenes. But to me, then that just brings me back to why, like, I don't really feel like I want to know someone's sort of private reckoning.
Exactly. But I think at the same time, you've got this thing going on where it is both an extremely personal story that I don't necessarily have any business knowing about. But at the same time, like, it's written often in these very kind of, I don't know, like, signposty, generalized statements about, like, for example, the AIDS trauma, right? Oh, like, it doesn't mean that you're all sick now. Or like there are these, like, sort of big signposty, bold, kind of two general statements that it uses to try to infuse it with specificity, but it comes out
feeling, right.
like, wait, dated or just almost luxury or something. And even in the relationship between between Harry and Adam, that discussion about like, well, you use the word queer, but I use the word gay, but gay means this to me, but queer means that to you. It just felt like
Twitter discourse.
Yeah, like an article from from 5 years ago or something.
Exactly.
Like, or more.
I didn't used to fuck very much because I thought if I fucked, I would die. Yeah, honey, I saw that on Tumblr in 2013. Get over it.
Right.
The movie jumps into so many of these weird contemporary.
It's so true. No, you're so right.
The queer versus gay thing, like, could have been a lot worse. It somewhat gently approaches that.
Okay, so before we go, we should. I think we do have to talk about this ending, because it is really something else. I was gasping in my house, and my two partners were also gasping, and not in a good way, I would say, about the twist. It really is again, spoiler alert, it really is a kind of a gay sixth sense moment where we find out that Adam has, I guess, inadvertently killed Harry by not letting him into his apartment. The first time they meet earlier in the movie, Harry comes to his door drunk and is like, I'd like to hook up with you, and he doesn't let him in. And we find out that all of the interactions throughout the rest of the movie were with another ghost, the ghost of Harry, because Harry's dead body has been like rotting in the bathtub in his apartment the entire time. But it's okay, because Adam invites his ghost from his apartment to come stay with him in the other apartment, and they become stars in the sky or something like that. So what did we make of this? Because it really took a turn for me there, and I had to kind of just like leave the room a little bit because I couldn't handle. But did this plot twist shock you guys? Did it make sense to you? Did it fit? What was your reaction?
I have a non-queer, like, wanting to argue about this instinct of this movie, is that I don't think one guy is dead. The what's the screenwriter's name?
Adam. Yeah, it's unclear if he's dead or not. Yeah, that's true.
Right, that seems to be, it's a purposeful ambiguity, so you're supposed to talk about it. That's not what I got, but my boyfriend who I saw with was like, oh no, I think he's dead too, that's why he's a star.
Right. Guy.
As we were talking about it, we were all just like, Jesus, what are you even saying?
Wait, talking about, right?
I mean, I think the real takeaway is never turn down a hookup, because if you don't have sex with that guy, he might
die.
That's how important it is to always take every opportunity to have sex.
I honestly, like, in that scene, I was like, what would I do in this situation, really? And I was like, maybe I would let him in. Maybe I would let him. He had Japanese whiskey. He's Paul Mescal. I don't know. Maybe I'd let
him. Yeah. And he lives in your building. So, like, you know, he has the credit score.
Right.
It's funny because there's like actually not that much to talk about at the end. It's so fucking weird. They literally float in the sky with like sentimental music. Like, if you haven't seen this movie, I don't know how to even describe it to you. But the whole theater, after when the lights came up, everybody was like, oh. And we just kind of like shuffled out in like a monotone because it's just, it's like, what is going on? But people seem to love the movie at the same time. It's a bizarre experience. I really meant to say more nice things about Andrew Hay, who I actually think is a very talented filmmaker.
I think we've talked about this movie enough. Please go check out All of Us Strangers. I'm sorry if we've been too negative, because a lot of people do love it. It is playing widely. We'd love to hear your thoughts. As always, you can write to us at outwardpodcast@slate.com.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
All right, well, that is almost all the time we have for this month. But before we go, as always, we have some updates to your gay agenda. Jules, why don't you start us off?
All right. Well, you know, January brings the Sundance Film Festival towards the end of the month. And I am a longtime fan. As someone who's been lucky enough to be a part of a film that premiered at Sundance a few years ago. And so I've been keeping my eye on what's going on this year from afar. And there's quite a lot of fascinating and important offerings going on, but I just want to direct everyone's attention to one of them, you know, for your gay agenda, which is the film Pony Boy that is getting a lot of buzz. This is a wonderful film that kind of follows up a short that folks may have encountered, you know, in the past. It's a wonderful film that follows an intersex sex worker in New Jersey named Pony Boy. And the movie takes place on a single Valentine's Day night. There's a lot that goes on. It's like a really, from what I haven't gotten the chance to see it yet. It's really kind of beautiful and heartfelt and funny and irreverent. And it features some incredible performances, and it introduces the world to the absolutely incredible actor River Gallo, who has also been just turning incredible looks at Sundance and giving fantastic interviews. I've just been delighted every time I see River Gallo on my social media feed. So, you know, this is sort of a funny gay agenda because, like, you can't really go back in time and go to Sundance to go watch this movie, but just, like, keep an eye out for Pony Boy, keep an eye on River Gallo, watch this space, support this film, and then when you do have a chance, really, really recommend going to see it. You know, I just think there's something really exciting and important and talented going on in this film and with these actors, and I'm just so excited to see all of them getting the kind of world stage that they deserve.
Ooh, that sounds so exciting. I would love to see that.
Yeah.
I will watch the space. And I'm going to check out those looks, too. I haven't seen any Sundance looks, so I should do that.
Yeah, it's always, like, a funny festival space because it's, like, I mean, this is not a culture I'm a part of. It's like Utah après-ski culture. So like people are dressed very differently in Park City, Utah than like at, you know, whatever Cannes or like something in Hollywood. So I think it's kind of hilarious to watch people from all over the country and all over the world have to learn how to wear like puffy jacket.
Puffy jacket.
Without like, you know.
How do you accessorize?
How do you accessorize? Yeah, no, but seriously, jacket. How do you not get swallowed up with that? That could be a whole gay agenda item in and of itself. But speaking of, Brian, what have you got?
I have got a really gay cookie recipe.
Oh my God. You are the sweetest.
There are all these movies and all these things. I could have brought something like that. But I was thinking of what's the truly the gayest thing that has been in my life in the last, I don't know, month or so. And it's actually this recipe. It's called Technicolor Cookies.
I was going to say, how is the cookie gay, but...
You will see. I mean, I will tell you.
The recipe is called Technicolor Cookies, and it's by Samantha Sinavaratna in the New York Times cooking app.
Which is a wonderful resource if you don't already use that. The recipe came out sort of in December, but they are these gorgeous shortbread cookies with a glaze that is, as the name suggests, Technicolor, like the most beautiful 6-7 color like stripes and swoops and swirls that you've ever seen. Ooh. And the color palette is very like sort of bright neon pastel-y, like gorgeous colors. It's done with this very fun ingredient that I've never used before called, it's food coloring, but it's gels. And so the color that you get from that is like a lot richer. And then you do this really cute technique where you make kind of like palette of the swooping colors, and then you dip your cookies in that so that you get all of these wonderful lines, and none of them are the same. They all like, they look, I wish you could, we're in an audio medium, but, if you could see it, each one is different. Each one, you know, is like a unique pattern. And they're so fun to play with. And you can use like the recipe is a shortbread, but I did mine actually with, crescent moon shaped, gingerbread cookies. And it was just so, and I put glitter on them because why not? And they're just gorgeous. So, we'll put the link in the show page to this recipe. But they're called Technicolor cookies. And yeah, if you're still in a cookie baking mood, even after the holidays, I have to recommend these because they're really fun and, they're very gay. Your friends will know that you are a avowed queer. If you,
they will know that you like crescents.
Crescents, yes. If you bring these to the party. So that's my recommendation.
That sounds delectable. Brian, are you a big baker?
I am I'd say so. I like to bake. Yeah, definitely. It's a fun part of my life sometimes. Jeff, I think you brought us a gay agenda item. Do you want to share that with our listeners?
Yes. So I've been it's a recipe for vinaigrette, so please stop listening now if that's so terrible that you can't bear it. There's a restaurant in New York City called Bouvette. It used to be Brian and I in our old days. Slate used to have an office in Manhattan in the around the corner. I go there now when I have the misfortune to be in Manhattan, and it's a lovely restaurant. It's a French restaurant. They have a location there. They have a location in Paris. It's just an old school bistro-ish French restaurant where they have like little dishes. Anyway, my boyfriend bought me their cookbook a couple of years ago because we like the restaurant. We go there when we go to movies in the area or something. And they have an excellent vinaigrette that does feel very gay. It's literally half Dijon mustard, half oil, and a little bit of cider vinegar, and then honey if you want. And lots of salt, obviously, because there's tons of fat. The reason I recommend it, there's something about the way that this cookbook is not like recipes like in the Molly Bass style. It's like this much more like just her telling stories about how she likes to eat, how she likes to drink wine, how like, you know, how to live basically. And this vinaigrette, like I make it all the time. And there's something about it that feels very like, I think that everyone who listens to this should try it. What I'm recommending is this book, which is just a super lovely sort of thing about cooking chicken and hay and like beef cheek stew and her family and growing up and how to drink and how to eat. And it's like there's something very renewing about it, particularly at the beginning of the year. I really recommend the book. I think you can get it for cheap online, and it's quite lovely.
Ooh, it sounds voluptuous, and I'm not mistaken. I don't think I am. I believe that she is a lesbian. Yeah, I think you're even more on point about that. Well, that sounds delicious. Oh my God, I love the mustardy vinaigrette. And listeners, I have to tell you, we didn't plan this, but two recipes in one show for Gay Agenda. All right, thank you, Jeff. that is the show for this week. As always, please send us feedback and topic ideas at outwardpodcast@slate.com or via Facebook or X at Slate Outward. Please remember that we're doing advice segments regularly. Those have been really fun so far, but, you know, for them to work, we need your questions. So send us any and all queer advice questions. Voice memo is preferred, but emails are also fine. And that's also at outwardpodcast@slate.com. And just a reminder that by joining Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like Working, and you'll never hit a paywall on the Slate site. To learn more about that, go to slate.com/outwardplus. Our show has been produced by the wonderful, wonderful Palace Shaw. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app, tell your friends about it, and you can rate and review the show so others can find and join in on the fun. Until next time, bye, Jules.
Bye, Brian.
Stay gay, everybody.